Today and tomorrow being the Labor Day weekend, we have the same schedule today and tomorrow. Tomorrow's the Sunday schedule also. So our plan is to start the Zriya, start planting, so to speak, by tomorrow. And today we'd like to finish up, if not the very beginning of tomorrow, but hopefully today, the introduction that we began on Thursday, where we looked at the question of the nature of the malachos, the fact that Shabbos has this very unusual structure, that the Torah tells us simply not to do malacha, and it was left to Chazal to explain to us what that means and what the 39 forms of malacha are. And we left open the question why that should be. Why is it that the Torah didn't just tell us don't write, don't plant, don't bake, etc. And instead left us this type of structure to figure out. And then we started the Mishnah, and we noted that the Mishnah has a formulation that's different than the Rambam. The Mishnah talks about Hazoreya, Hachoresh, etc., while the Rambam talks about actions, Harisha, and Zriya. And we mentioned Rav Yosef Engel's suggestion about how to understand that there is a major issue, perhaps, that's being alluded to. And this was a topic of a major fight, and has implications throughout Hilchos Shabbos. And that's why it's, in addition to being relevant to this Mishnah that we're starting, and perhaps something we can read into the words of the Mishnah itself, it's a very major topic that's going to affect all of Hilchos Shabbos, and worth trying to get some clarity on at the very beginning. That is it perhaps true that there is a focus when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos on the individual rather than on the action? That maybe when it comes to Shabbos, the issue is that you should be at rest. And therefore, we're interested in the Mishnah in Hazoreya Hachoresh rather than an abstract act of Zriya and Karisha separate from the person. That's the Yisod, as we started to explain on Wednesday, that many Achronim signed on to. Many did not sign on to. This is somewhat of a fight, which we'll talk about a little bit. And even those who signed on to it, signed on to different versions. So we're going to try to talk about how we can deepen this idea, how we can analyze whether it's true or not, and it's going to have implications throughout Hilchos Shabbos, so it's something that's important to keep in mind. So the impetus for the question, the reason many of the Achronim, such as the Beis Meir and others, came up with this idea is because they were trying to figure out why do we need a din of Amir al Akum Shvus. Why is it that there's a din d'rabbanan that you're not allowed to ask a non-Jew to do malacha? Why don't we say that it's an issur d'oraisa, that there's an issue of shlichus, that if I ask somebody to do something on my behalf, very often that's effective because of shlucho shalom kamosa. So too, let's say it's effective here, that if I ask somebody to do mechal Shabbos for me, that counts against me as well. Now you could have other objections. You could say, in shlichus la'akum, shlichus doesn't work for a non-Jew. So many assume that we do say that it does work if it is local, but it does work against you. So that might not be the problem here, so to speak. It may not be an impediment. You could say, in shlichus l'dvar aveira, maybe there's never shlichus for an iser. It's a question what that means, what the parameters are of that. So many assume that's not an impediment here either. So theoretically, you could have had shlichus, you could appoint somebody to do an aveira for you, and you can appoint the non-Jew to an aveira, and still, apparently, it's not Mr. Daraisa to have that take place on Shabbos. That's the question that the Beis Meir and others asked. So the answer that he gave, So the answer that many Achronim gave is the reason it's Mr. Drabana and not Mr. Daraisa is because there's no shlichus on Shabbos. That Shabbos is about you, it's not about what takes place. So if you have somebody do malacha for you, that's not considered to be a violation on a Torah level of malacha Shabbos. Now, as we'll see, there are different versions of this. Even if you agree with this principle, there's different ways to say it. This sounds like a classic Chepsa Gavra distinction that you're familiar with in the world of Bris, the idea of saying that we can look at the individual, the Gavra, or we can look at the result, the Maisa, the Chepsa, taking place on Shabbos. It sounds like that type of a standard distinction that we're saying Shabbos is a din in the gavra. That's how many do phrase it. There are those who don't say it's exactly like that. Let's see that it may make a difference. those who say it's not about looking at the Gavra so much, it's a practical issue. That Shabbos means you should be at rest. You should not be doing Malacha. And if Malacha is happening, but you're still at rest, even if we still could connect that to you and call that a Gavra issue, we still might say that's not a violation of Shabbos. Some will formulate it that way, that the whole issue of Shabbos is about being at rest. Because that's what the Pasuk of Yesaras Adibro says. That's what we saw on Wednesday. The Pasuk says, Laman Yanuach, you should be at rest. That's the purpose of Malach. If you are at rest, you are keeping Shabbos, in that sense, Shmirat Shabbos, literally. And it doesn't matter the fact that you are provoking a Malacha through somebody else. Others will say it differently. For example, Rabbi Yosef Engel, who was the one who said that that might be pshat in this Mishnah. So he doesn't like the pshat. He says that according to those who agree with this whole idea, maybe that's what the Mishnah is getting at. And the reason he doesn't like it is because he associates it with a whole different attitude. He says there are those who maintain that anything that's temporary, any temporary iser, cannot be an iser chazer. For example, if you say that chazer is an iser in itself, there's something inherently wrong with chazer. We'll call that an iser chazer. But maybe chametz, the whole discussion, maybe chametz, you can't call that an iser chazer. Chametz, 51 weeks of the year, is completely kosher. So you're going to tell me that on Pesach, it changes its nature and now the object is bad? Can't be, according to some halachos. You have to say that there's an iser on the individual. We'll call that an iser gavra. You are not allowed to eat chametz, but the chametz is the same chametz that it was all year round. Or let's say even more blatantly, on Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, we're going to say that all food in the world suddenly changed its nature and now became an iser chefzah, 364 days, 365 days a year, all food is fine. And then, all of a sudden, Yom Kippur became inherently bad. Some find that very hard to say. Say if it's a temporary iser, if it's a one day a year iser, it must be that it's about the individual. So that's the approach that Joseph Engel is following. He says that those who maintain such an approach would say on Shabbos it's the same issue. That since Shabbos is one day a week, you can't tell me that an act of planting, an act of plowing, an act of baking, 6 days a week is fine, and all of a sudden on Shabbos it becomes something bad. It must be that Shabbos is about the actor and not about the creation. However, he doesn't sign on to this whole issue. He doesn't believe, personally, that a temporary iser cannot have an inherent status. He's saying, according to those, many who take that approach, it would come out that way in Shabbos as well. So that already gives us two different ways of saying it. That either Shabbos is about the individual because it's a temporary one-day-a-week iser, or because of the language of the Pasuk, that the Pasuk says, Laman Yanuach, it's all about your being at rest. So if you're at rest, then it doesn't matter what is actually taking place at your instigation. There's various ways of saying it, but that's the basic idea. The Shabbos is about you. And among those who disagree, the name is familiar for other writings, be familiar for many things, Shlomo Yosef Zevi. You might be familiar because he also published the works of Hasidic stories, but he published also the Encyclopedia Talmudis. The only Bucky in many different areas of life. He wrote about Halakha, he wrote about Hashkafah, he wrote about Tanakh, he wrote about Shakespeare, he wrote about everything. So, in a safe for Lor Halakha, he also has an essay about Shakespeare, he has an essay about Shabbos. And in that essay, he takes issue with all these other moments. He tries to prove that Shabbos is not about you, but it is about the environment that's created. And that it's not just about your being at rest, but it's also about the reality of Malachos not happening. So what are the different angles one can take? What are different proofs that one could bring into this discussion? So I mentioned one interesting point before we start, in terms of just deepening the idea before we get into some of the proofs. So the Rabbi Karelitz, in his Shiurim on Shabbos, on Chut HaShani, he noted something interesting. The Yerushalmi talks about many things. One of the things the Yerushalmi talks about, we'll get into it more later in the week, talks about the definition of Zoreya.
And included in Zoreh, according to Yerushalmi, are many acts that support the growth of a plant, and also acts that don't necessarily support the growth of the plant, but preserve the plant. Don't bring the plant any further, but preserve it in its current state. And he notes through this Koelis that in Shemitah, this would not be a problem. And when it comes to Shemitah, Shemitah is about growing things, and about plants being brought into the world, to focus on the result. So therefore, when it comes to Shemitah, we're only interested in not advancing the growth of the plant. When it comes to Shabbos, it's not just about making progress. It's also about actions that you do to preserve the current state. Because if we're looking at it from your perspective, from the perspective of the actor, so you're still doing something. You're still doing something towards this plant. As far as the plant's perspective, it's not changing. It's just holding its ground. But from your perspective, you're still doing the action. So they suggest this shows the difference between Shabbos and Shemitah. Here, in this case, it's Lachomra. That we're focused on you rather than focused as much on what's happening. Another issue we could bring up, just to deepen our understanding of what we mean when we say it's a gavrinus or not the proper language. So let me ask you the following question. So let's say we're going to maintain that it's true that if I ask a non-Jew to do malacha for me on Shabbos, on a level min haTorah, before we come on to the Bureau of Ashram, on a level min haTorah, I didn't do anything wrong. No malacha. Because I'm at rest, he doesn't have a prohibition of doing malacha on Shabbos, so no other place on a level min haTorah. If we grant that premise, based again on the idea that there's no shlichus, because I'm at rest, so it doesn't matter, what if I ask a Jew to do malacha for me on Shabbos? Well, he's not really doing it either. But I'm not doing anything. I'm the rest. Would we say the same thing? Would we say that I'm completely off the hook? What do you think?
But you're on
right. I'd definitely be over on, let's say, with the Yivrolosi Ken Mitchell, but I'm definitely doing it either. But what about Chil Shabbos? Am I Mechal Shabbos in that case? What do you think?
Is there
right, so that could also be in the same category we're talking before that, it's maybe other issues.
Right.
In terms of malacha, am I off the hook for a malacha if I have another Jew do malacha for me on Shabbos? So a number of Achronim say no, it's not comparable. That when you ask a non-Jew, so he's not prohibited from malacha on Shabbos, so he's okay. You're at rest, so you're okay. No Chil Shabbos really took place, so on a level min haTorah, there's no issue. But if you ask a Jew to do malacha for you on Shabbos, so there is a violation of Shabbos happening. A Jew is now not at rest on Shabbos, and you brought that about. So that does trace back to you. So in a sense, it's not really that there's no shlichus at all. But if you're using a Jew, there would be a type of shlichus, because now you are linked to an act of Chil Shabbos that's happening through a Jew. So this kind of sharpens the idea that it's not totally like there's no violation of Shabbos if you are passive. If you're causing a Jew to violate Shabbos, that might trace back to you. It's only when you're dealing with a non-Jew, so you're at rest and there's no Chil Shabbos happening, so you're okay. Let's see
that first. Then, I've heard about Shabbos concept that we were causing this. The reason for Shabbos is because we want to be established as Shabbos created the world, so we can't do any love because we're creating something from human hands of fire, planting. So that's true. I mean, I don't know if we, it should matter if the end result is creating something new, not like the ash itself. I mean, like, why can't we inherit the books of kind of like the stairs that we can't do more
life? Right, so that seems to be consistent with the idea that it's all about your creating, that you want to let God be the creator and not your creator. You actually have to figure out how that matches with the idea that you're keeping Shabbos because Baruch Hu himself took off Shabbos. If Shabbos was just based on the 6 days of creation, that'd be one thing. If it's based on the seventh day, when it comes from himself, I could figure out from Hashem's perspective how exactly that matches up. But I think you're right that on some level there is a connection there. Who was up first?
Does that have anything to do with the idea of harmony?
So it does on a larger level. That, you know, there could be that, again, in terms of, let's say, like you said before, there could be a lifnei-iver issue. You're definitely violating something if you make a Jew do malacha for you. But here the suggestion is that maybe it's more than that, that maybe that's a full malacha, so to speak, because now you're making an actual malacha happen at your instigation that is considered directly traced back to you. So this just takes the idea to a different level, that we're not saying there's no shlichus at all. There could be shlichus if you're having an actual malacha happen. It's just that a malacha happened through a Jew. It's just that when you have a non-Jew as a Shia, so then there's no shlichus because he's not prohibited, so there's no malacha, and you're not doing anything from either. So we'll see whether or not that is consistent with every possible proof, and we'll try to look at how some of the points support or don't support this idea. Hi.
Are we saying that you prefer Yosef Engel? Even he has to agree that if you cause him a Jew in the law, that's
probably... No, so he probably, according to his formulation, which he doesn't like anyway, he would probably agree that, no, it's still a necessary Zman, therefore it might still be an Aveira, but it wouldn't necessarily have the entity, wouldn't be any different, probably, at least as far as you're concerned.
He still maintains that it's Zman, even though he doesn't like the actual Shita.
Right, he doesn't believe the Shita, but he says, according to those who say it, that's what it would play out that way.
So what does he end up holding?
He ends up holding that Nisra Zman can have a Nisra Chetza and the Nisra Drabanan can have a Nisra Chetza, which he also talks about there. He's not into the whole thing. He's saying, according to you guys who like this board, then this could be a mess. So what are some of the proofs and what are some of the issues that are debated? Hi.
So he says it's about creating the atmosphere of rest. Does that mean it's action-related?
Right, you said like Rav Zevin, it's about an atmosphere, it means it's not action-related. And most of the Aharonim say it's action-related. Right. It's all about you. You're doing something. Oh, action mean that an action word?
The result.
Right. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
The result.
First. Right. Result. I mean, atmosphere would mean it's result related. Yes.
Those two connect together.
Those two, right. Those two would connect together. Correct. So Rav Zevin would say it's about result and about having not malachas take place, not having malachas take place, and not about you're not doing it. Okay. So what are some of the proofs that are brought into this discussion? So one proof, which I put on the list there, very worth you seeing now because it comes up all the time in Hilchos Shabbos. It's going to come up in Zoreya, so it's worth getting out of the table now. It is a very often quoted Nebuchadnezzar Yosef in Bava Kamma. Nebuchadnezzar Yosef deals with the position of Yochanan. Whether or not it's relevant to this discussion is an open issue. Many thought that this was relevant. Cypher, for example, quotes this Nebuchadnezzar Yosef and says, you can see from this Nebuchadnezzar Yosef that he doesn't agree with what we've been saying till now. And just methodologically, it has to do with what do? When you see, for example, it happens with Tosafot all the time. You have a certain point, and you think it's true. And you see Tosafot asks a question, and your point could answer that question. So you might think, this is a proof that I'm right, because it answers the question. The Tosafot doesn't say that answer. So is that a proof that you're wrong? Because if you were right, Tosafot would have said the answer. Or is it a proof that you're right? Because it answers the question well. So this is the kind of proof that can go in both directions. So that's what you have here as well. This principle could answer the question of Nebuchadnezzar Yosef that we're about to describe. And the fact that he doesn't say that answer may or may not be a proof for this position. What's his question? His question is that Rav Yochanan argues with Reish Lakish in the Gemara in the second parak of Bava Kamma. But how do we characterize that hezek done by fire? If I set fire to something, I am liable, it's one of the avos in the fact that it's avos discussion is only one thing. But one of the avos in the zikin is setting fire to something. Now here, that's a nezek which there could be a time delay. I could set a fire, and the fire may take a couple of hours to spread, and then maybe it damages something a few hours from now. So how do we relate to that fact that this is happening at a distance? It doesn't seem to be an obviously direct action. It's not like I take a sledgehammer and I smash something that happens right now. I set a fire, I go to sleep, I wake up in the morning, I find it in front of me. So according to Reish Lakish, we treat that like it's your property. Like my ox. I let my ox out of this gate. And then I find out the next day that it's knocked down a china shop. So
So then that's my liability. I have to pay for that. The owner would say, I knocked down the giant shop.
He'd say, my ox did, and I have to pay for it because it's my ox. No, that's not a grub. That's one of the others that he can. That's not called Rama, yeah, because that's one of the obvious Ezekiel tells him in the category that if your property goes out and just does something, I didn't make it do it, I just was liable for it because I should have guarded my property. And
but that's like the whole issue of the Shabbos, like this car happening, setting up buckets around
it. But there you're purposely setting it up that way. Here, I'm not purposely setting up the Nezek, this is my liability. The Rama is relevant in the legal context. So, that being the case, that was the view of Reish Lakish. Rabbi Yochanan said no. Rabbi Yochanan said that essentially, even though it was a fine delay, we still connected to you as a direct action. But it's essentially like an arrow. It says, Eish Mishum Tetzin. In the modern world, we could use better examples because there are different weaponry that's going to take more time to get somewhere to make the example even better. Let's say you send a missile. And a missile takes a few minutes to get somewhere. So there's a fine delay again. But it's pretty clear that I set off the missile. I should have done it somewhere. So it takes a few seconds for the bullet to get there, but I shot the gun. That's clearly my action. It's not that my bullet ran off on its own and did damage. It's something that I did. So Rabbi Yochanan's view of fire is that we'll view it like an arrow, like a bullet. It's something that I clearly set into motion and sent it to its destination. So ask the Nehubi Yosef, according to that, how do we allow people, and in fact require people, have Shabbos candles on their dinner table. So you have a flame that's lit Friday night. You lit it. Right? Maybe your wife lit it, whatever, was lit by you or your wife Friday afternoon. So if we say that it's all as if it's your action, so here you have the candles going Friday night, and you lit them, it traces back to you. Why is that not a violation of Havara? Why is that not as if you're lighting a candle? Then, according to Rabbi Yochanan's view, then all is considered to be an action of you. Now, according to our principle, we could say very well. Right? We could say that it doesn't matter if it's counted as if you're doing it. The fact is, you are sitting there right now not doing anything. At no time since Shabbos came in have you disturbed your rest by setting a fire. So we can count this against you as an act of hesed, but it's not a violation of Shabbos. If the yisod that we're saying is true, that as long as you are physically at rest, as long as you are not doing an action, you're not in violation of Shabbos. So no malachus here is going to make a difference. No view of how you characterize fire is going to turn this into a malacha for you. So that's the issue here, that this yisod, this principle seems to answer the question. Right? Anyone follow it? It seems to be that if this is really true, but as long as you're physically at rest, you're not doing a malacha, so then having candles that were lit before Shabbos at your table shouldn't even be a question. Okay, did you have a question about that?
I just mentioned the question. I don't understand how you can assume that concept onto
the
Shabbos.
Well, it's all about the Ezekiel, the Nehubi Yosef's question.
Right.
Right. You're saying that you're working with
Ezekiel about.
You're working backwards, saying the answer seems obvious. Well, so the answer that Rabbi Yosef himself gives, it might be why you don't understand the question, is that he gives a different answer. That's why some Afronim think this challenges this Yisod. Because according to this Yisod, you can say, that's the answer, end of story. And he gives a different answer, which may be the answer you're thinking of. And that's why the Stipler says, and many others raise this issue as well, oh, apparently the Rabbi Yosef doesn't agree with this. Because what does he say? He says, this may be what you're getting at, there's a difference. We're talking about Nezikin and we're talking about Hilchos Shabbos. In terms of Nezikin, we're talking about your liability. So your liability is considered to be a direct act that you were doing. But in terms of Hilchos Shabbos, so when did you do your act? You did your act at the very beginning. It all goes back to that first moment. So let's say even, for example, for the purposes of Nezikin, I set a fire at 8 o'clock and it damages something at 12 o'clock. So my liability is of a direct act. And the act that I committed at 8 o'clock. The damage is done later, but it all goes back to that initial moment when I committed it. And therefore, that's how we view it. So as far as Hilchos Shabbos, it shouldn't be an issue because that's all his position means. So there are those who maintain that this is a proof against the principle. So again, it's a general methodological issue. What do you do when you have a Rishon who asks the question? which your Kiddush answers up, well, is that a proof for you? Or is that a proof against you? Because the Rishon doesn't give that answer.
So that's a general attitudinal issue. But there's much discussion about this new Yosef that revolves around this type of approach.
That could even be true, even if, let's say, you lit a fire right before Shabbos and you got to do something on Shabbos. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't be a problem for Shabbos, but it would be a problem for this weekend.
Yeah, that's probably very likely the case, right? Because in terms of Havara, the Havara, the act of lighting, is on Shabbos. In terms of your liability for what you damage, you can sure you're liable anyway, even though you're not around now. Right, that's for sure, true. So, there are a number of different approaches you can take to this. Either you could say the question of the root principle, you could say the existence of a different answer is proof that the Nemuki Yosef at least didn't agree, and maybe that's a strike against it. Or you could say that the Nemuki Yosef agrees, and I think this is maybe what Dave is getting at. Nemuki Yosef could agree with this principle, but he thinks you don't have to come on to it for this question. I could answer this question in a simpler way, and therefore maybe the principle is true, but it's not even worth asking the question from that angle. Or you could say a fancy shot. For example, look in the Sefer, the popular Sefer, contemporary Sefer on Chumash, called the Chavetzelos HaSharon Al HaTorah, where he suggests that the issue is that there's two different issues here. One issue is the individual being at rest, but there's also an issue that maybe the shlichus is one thing. And if you say there's no shlichus, I could accept that, because shlichus means, what does shlichus mean in general? The whole discussion in the Akron of Joseph Engel somewhere else about what I say about this. That if I have you do a mitzvah on my behalf, so we know the concept of shlichus, when it works, if I do a mitzvah on my behalf, I get credited with that mitzvah. So what does that mean? Does that mean it's like I physically did that mitzvah? Or does it mean, no, I didn't physically do the mitzvah, I was listening to that. But it means the halacha allows me to fulfill a mitzvah that way. I can be credited with your action that you did that counts on my account. It goes into my bank account. Yes, sir?
But it's more than that. It's not only that you're just getting what counted, that you caused it to happen.
Right. So the question, what does that mean practically? So I caused it. So the halakha tells me, shlucho shalakha kamoso, I can be credited with that mitzvah. Why? Credited because I brought it about and you did it for me. Or credited even more so because, like, you are my hand, you're my worker. So that's a whole discussion I'm going to have. How do you understand shlichus? So here he suggests, Chavetzelos HaSharon, that maybe you could say shlichus, okay, there's no shlichus by Shabbos. Because all it would mean is that you are credited, or in this case, blamed for the action. Okay, let you be blamed for the action, but you're still at rest. But the Rabbi Yosef's issue about fire is not talking about shlichus. He's saying that according to Rabbi Yochanan, maybe lighting a fire means that your action extends beyond the time that you set the fire. And maybe Rabbi Yochanan meant that when I set a fire and the fire burns for 3 hours, it's like I'm doing something for 3 hours. And the Mukhi Yosef then comes to answer, no, it doesn't mean that. It all means my actions in the first minute, but liability-wise, it all goes. So maybe the Mukhi Yosef would agree, shlichus is not about you doing anything. But this fire issue, that is about you doing something potentially. And his answer is that no, it doesn't even mean that. So it's neither shlichus nor an issue that lighting a fire is all considered to be one long, ongoing action. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. I'm just worried about that. Like, it seems obvious to me that, of course, when you start something before Shabbat, you can do the job, it shouldn't be a problem. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why lighting would be considered to be an issue.
Right, so he seems to be saying that maybe Rabbi Yochanan's point is that when you say it's considered to be a direct action, he argues with Rish Lakish. So Rish Lakish says it's not your action, it's a bull in a china shop. The bull is not your action, it's just your responsibility. So Rabbi Yochanan says, no, it is your action. So what does he mean by that? Does he mean that you're constantly doing the action? So his answer in the end is no, you're not constantly doing the action. You did the action when you lit the fire. It's just always considered like it's your direct responsibility, as opposed to simply being your property that got out of control. But you could have thought, until he answered the question, you could have thought that Rabbi Yochanan's issue, when it came to argue about what fire is, maybe he meant that it's like a constant action. So at the end of the day, the answer is no.
It's not a liability issue.
All right, I'll go back to that first minute. Okay, everyone following so far?
So that's a little bit of the discussion that goes around this proof. That goes around the proof of the Mukiyosef's issue when it comes to fire. And it's going to come up a lot. It's going to come up when we talk about Zoray, because Zoray will also have somewhat of a similar structure. So in general, holding on to this Mukiyosef in your back pocket, being aware of the discussion, is Kedai, because it comes up a lot. It's a very frequently cited source in the Lomas and Shabbos. Second area where this comes up, this is another methodological question. So one question we just dealt with is what do you do when there's a Rishon who asks you a question, or asks a question that helps you to show and give you an answer. And you could use that as a proof either way, either because your answer helps or because the fact that you didn't give your answer is against you. There's another issue which you go into. What do you do when there's a Din D'Rabbanan that says, let's say, the opposite of yours? Let's say you want to say a certain principle, and there's a Din D'Rabbanan that says the opposite. Do we say that that's a proof for your Yisod? Because if your Yisod was wrong, it shouldn't be a Din D'Rabbanan, it should be a Din D'Rabbanan. The fact that something is quote-unquote only a D'Rabbanan, maybe that's a proof, and you're your soul that's different than this thing is true. Or you could say the opposite. You could say the fact that Chazal made a Din D'Rabbanan that argues with your principle shows you that they argue with your principle. They feel that they should make laws that are consistent with opposing your principle. Follow the issue? Yes, sir.
Can you give an example?
Yes, here's an example. This is the case we're talking about. We just said that asking somebody to do a malach on your behalf, according to Torah law, is nothing, according to the principle. There's no shlichus for an akum, at least if you're using a non-Jew, there's no shlichus for malach on Shabbos. But we know that midrabanan is for sure prohibited. It's amir al-akum. So that could be cited as a proof for whichever side you like. Because you could say, well, the fact that it's only Isra Rabbanan and not Asur B'nan Torah shows you this Yisod is true. And that's how this question got off the ground. How come this issue is Rabbanan and not B'nan Torah? Or you could say the opposite. You could say the fact that Chazal made this law shows you that maybe there is an issue which is maybe not enough for it to be an existing Torah law, but enough that they should at least make a Din D'Rabbanan that reflects that. So this is another type of proof question. When you have something that's a Din D'Rabbanan and not a D'Raisa, is it relevant more that it's not a D'Raisa? Or is it relevant more that Chazal made the D'Rabbanan? Follow the whole issue? So this is, again, a part of the discussion. What do we do with a Amir al-Akum? The fact that it's a D'Rabbanan shows us this principle is true, or the fact that it exists at all shows us that the principle is not so true. Yes, sir?
I thought with the Rabbanan, just that it's just that the Rabbanan had this methodology that derived from the Torah, that the poems are showing this, but it's really from the Torah, they just say it explicitly.
So right, that's really two separate categories. That's Torah Shval Peh. Torah Shval Peh is considered to be the Minhag Torah, but we have the Rabbanan explained to us from the Gedera Shavuot and the Talmud Chumash. That's different. That's Torah Shval Peh. But, and that's what a little bit we're asking here, how come the Malachos themselves be Parashat Baal Peh as opposed to Parashat Tzav. But a Din D'Rabbanan is something that the rabbis are innovating themselves, not from something. And then the question is, what does that reflect? So that's in general a question that's part of this whole debate. Does Amir al-Akum show that there's no shuchas to show that there is shuchas? So for example, the first Babish Rebbe in the Shulchan Aruch Harad, he says this shows that really there is a shuchas. That since in general we are a machmir and assumes at least drabanan for shlichus through a non-Jew, so therefore that's why it's a din drabanan of amir al-akum, because there is such a concept of shlichus by Shabbos, and that's what's going on. And as we said, others will take the opposite approach, which is a part of how the whole conversation got started to begin with. So some will point out, take a put on the line of Gomos, there's a Rashi in Shabbos and Kufun Gimel where he sounds very much like there is a concept of Shlichus. Because the Gemara Mishnah first talks about somebody who is traveling on Erev Shabbos and he gets stuck on the road and he has his wallet on him and he's traveling with non-Jews, so he could ask one of the non-Jews to carry his wallet for him. And the Gemara asks, because he's doing this before Shabbos, he's doing this Friday afternoon, when he realizes that it's going to get rain. So the Gemara asks, why is it that we allow this? So why shouldn't we allow it? So Rashi over there says, apparently it's surprising that we allow it, because the Aklum is Kishlucho, is like his messenger.
Isn't it Motza, which is the Rabbanan anyways?
So Motza is also Motza, it's also apparent.
Yeah, but if he's in the same Rishus the whole time, then there is Motza.
If he doesn't move, like he's outside.
If he's just constantly outside,
he's
in Rishus the Rabbanan.
If he's in Rishus the Rabbanan, he carries down the Rabbanan. So
if you only move down to Rishus the Rabbanan,
yeah.
All it does is only move one Rishus.
Two different types. Right? One to go to Marshall's next, and also to go to the Pramah. So that type of Chotzah, so that's going to be a deraisa. So Rashi that says, because he is like his Shlucho, that's why it's a question why we should allow. So there are many who say, the base mayor, for example, one of the big proponents of this whole Shlichus thing, but he raises this question. He says, here Rashi seems to be saying that there is Shlichus, that it's a problem. That this non-Jew is going to be Kishlucho, like Kishliach, to carry your stuff on Shabbos. That doesn't think the problem.
But Rashi says it's only the Rabbanan issue, so you're when you have to be lactate to begin with, it's only the Rabbanan.
That's the Gemara's premise. The Gemara wants to know how were they able to allow it, and it sounds like it's a real issue of Shliach. I say sounds like because it is vague, how to read it. And the answer, which may be what you're getting at, that the Chassam Sofer suggests, again, the Chassam Sofer himself being one of the proponents in this Shlichus view that we mentioned on Wednesday. So here the Chassam Sofer in his Chedushim to Shabbos, he, in a couple of places, he says he doesn't think Rashi means that this is an actual act of Shlichus. He's talking about the appearance of this, and it's not even a normal Amira L'Hakum, because here he's talking about before Shabbos. So already it's a different type of gather. And the Chassam Sofer in general understands that Rashi is not talking about an actual act of Shlichus. He's saying that since this person essentially becomes connected to him as part of his traveling group, isn't that something that creates a concern? And that's what the Gemara comes to answer. Essentially, he just doesn't take this Rashi literally, doesn't think that Rashi is telling us that there's an actual act of Shlichus here that has to be weighed in as a proof against this.
He would feel that this is the case, or he would definitely, yeah, even though Sarah Shabbos now is 100% sure that, let's say, they're so far away from anywhere that the Goy would be definitely carrying this on Shabbos, let's say, in a couple hours. Mm-hmm. Then would the Chassam Sofer be able to learn out like the base fare?
Yeah, I think he still thinks that Rashi is not, the whole point is just what does Rashi mean when he says the word Shliach? Is Rashi telling us there's an actual Shlichus? He doesn't think it's literal. That's really the whole focus, just how much is weight put on that word Shlichus. That's another major proof text that goes back and forth in this whole discussion. How much weight do we put on the Shlichus issue? The fact that there is a Amir al-Aqab in the Rabbanan, does that show us that it's only the Rabbanan, so that shows its principle? Or the fact that it exists at all maybe is a reflection of the opposite of this. Another issue, we have the same question, which direction are we going in? You have the Dindra Rabbanan, what does it show us? There's the Gemara of Chulin, and the Afkufi Dalit. It also should be on the list. But the Gemara talks about the prohibition of Maisa Shabbos. It's also important to get out of the way now, because it also comes up all the time, that Maisa Shabbos is a Dindra Rabbanan. Like that Min HaTorah, the Gemara tells us over there that Maisa Shabbos is Mutter. The result of what you did on Shabbos, you create something on Shabbos that is not prohibited to benefit from. Midrabanan, we have a prohibition. You cook food on Shabbos, so midrabanan, we have a whole list of prohibitions about benefiting from that. But Min HaTorah is mutter.
Once you did the malach.
Right, once you did the malach, you're allowed to benefit from it. And the Gemara derives that from the pasuk, because the Gemara says that when it comes to bishul basar mechala, you cook meat and milk. So we know that that combination is also to eat and to benefit from. So what's the source of that? So the source of that could be the fact that Torah says three times most of that should be eaten. But the Gemara also raises the principle, kol shetiyahavtilacha hareinu b'bal tochel, that anything that the Torah calls an abomination, you can't benefit from. So since the Torah says that it's a Torah that makes meat and milk, so that's combination. So Gemara says, so why shouldn't we also say that results of Chilul Shabbos are equally usur, just like pasuk v'chalav? And the Gemara says, no, we can derive from a pasuk. Pasuk says that Shabbos is kodesh, is off limits kodesh, so to speak. So says the Gemara, he kodesh, ve'ein maaseh kodesh. That it is holy and its results, its effects, don't have the din of off limits. And I consider it to be asur minat Torah.
How is that exactly?
That you might think that just like creating pasuk v'chalav, not only are you not allowed to do that, but the result is also off limits, is also not kosher. So too, when it comes to Chilul Shabbos, you're not allowed to do it, and what comes out should also be off limits.
Doesn't say whatever.
So it has a different angle. So yeah, that the act is off limits, the creation is off limits, so therefore the result should also be off limits. The Gemara says, no, you kodesh vein maaseh. So here you have the same kind of question we asked a minute ago. But now we expand it a little bit because there's three prongs. What is the most significant fact? The fact that min haTorah the result is mutter. The fact that mit derabbanan is asur. Or the fact that the Gemara needed a pasuk to tell you that min haTorah is mutter. I would have thought it was asur. The pasuk tells me it's mutter. And then the rabbis came and prohibited it again. What's the most significant fact out of those three facts? What sheds the most light on what's going on? Because it seems to be that if we're only interested in the individual, Shabbos is an issue that you shouldn't cook, not that cooking shouldn't happen. So then it would seem that after the fact, it shouldn't have any effect. Okay, you should not have cooked. But now that you cook, the food should be mutter. And it would seem to me that if we're following this principle, that should be the conclusion. So what's the most relevant fact for this Gemara conclusion? The fact that the rabbis prohibited the result? The fact that the Torah did not prohibit the result? Or the fact that the Gemara had to ask the question and use a pasuk to teach us that the Torah didn't prohibit the result? Three different directions you can go into three different parts of this discussion. So it's the same type of proof that can be used for any position that you want. There are those who will say this is reflective of the fact that there is something wrong on Shabbos with the action itself, with the result of the action. Because the Gemara needs a pasuk to say this. The Shoal of Nation, for example, the tremendous post that you're building, Shoal of Nation. He was the author of trillion Jews. It's an unbelievable amount of Jews. The Shoal Nation has big volumes. He has Madura Kama, Madura Tinyama, he has many different Maduras. Each one, he has 1,000 Jews in tiny little print. He just wrote a phenomenal amount of it. So he was a major posek. So he thought this was a bomb question. He said, how could it be that the Gemara thinks that the Maisa should be awesome, that the result should come out prohibited, if all we care about is your being addressed? If you're going to tell me, says the Goshen Shoal Nation, the Shoal Nation, if you're going to tell me that it's all about your not doing anything, so it should be obvious that the result has no issue. You've already done your Avera, so now you did your Avera, I should be able to use the food. The fact that the Gemara needs a pasuk, says the Shoal Meisher, that's a riot of this whole Shlichus story is wrong. We're not just concerned about your being at rest, we're concerned about the Malacha happen. Then he goes on to say, oh, but what about all these Achronim who have great questions and great proof that maybe Shlichus doesn't apply in Shabbos? So then he says, you know what, maybe you're right. Maybe there's a way to save that part of it while still taking a different approach. Says maybe there's no shlichus on Shabbos. You know why? Whole different reason. As we said before, there are many different ways to come to this conclusion. Says maybe there's no shlichus on Shabbos because Shabbos has this issue of meleches machsheves, and we know there has to be a strong connection between the action and the intent. So if I have somebody else do a melacha for me,
So I don't have that connection anymore.
One guy is moving it, one guy is thinking about it, one guy is ordering it, he's providing the machshava, and a different guy is doing the action. So it's a break in malachas and machshavas. So says the Sholomation, that's what I think. I think shlichus is right, it doesn't work. But not because it's all about your being at rest, because if you do a full malacha, then that should change the result. And it's only because the Gemara comes and tells us that it's a pasuk that says otherwise, and the result is okay. Follow that was very complicated. Follow that all back and forth. So again, our whole three stages of what's significant: the havamina, the maskana, or the dinder abana. So according to the Sholomation, the havamina is very significant. It's in his mind a bomb kasha. In fact, the Gemara thinks that the result should be usher, and only has a pasuk to tell you it's mutter. Shows you that the result itself is bad. And that challenges the whole shlichus thing. So he says, yeah, I still believe that the result is bad. And shlichus doesn't apply for a different reason. It doesn't apply because you're splitting the act and the machshava, and therefore it's a technical flaw. So although that one who says shlichus don't work, you're right, but not because of this whole principle that it's all about the individual being in there. So far, so good? Yes, sir.
It's a simple question. Why didn't you say, well, the Torah doesn't want you benefiting from something that's clearly bad? Mm-hmm. Meaning, Habamina, we thought there was a Knas D'Oraisa or something along those lines. Maskana, there's no Knas D'Oraisa.
Right, the question whether or not you really have such an idea of a Knas D'Oraisa, at least an obvious way. Like, for example, you might say a Mamzer is an example of a Knas D'Oraisa, but that's its own Kiddush. We don't know a Mamzer automatically. It's a separate din of a Mamzer. So we don't necessarily have an indication that when you do an Avera, the Torah, it automatically creates a prohibitive result.
That's what the Gemara is discussing. The Gemara is saying that by Mas B'chal, we see a precedent for it, so maybe there is such a thing as Knas D'Oraisa. So Maskana, no, there's no Knas D'Oraisa. It's a Kiddush by Mas B'chal.
I think you're right, that's a decent way to approach it, that might show that it's a general Torah thing, not a specific Shabbos thing. But the Sholomation will say, yeah, but it shows you it's a general Torah thing, which includes Shabbos. Shabbos operates the same way. So apparently that's what you would have thought. And Gemara has to bring a proof not that way. So again, it's a question, what do you put more emphasis on? You put more emphasis on the proof that shows you Shabbos is different, or more emphasis on the question which seems Shabbos should have been in the broader picture. It's six of one and a half dozen of the other. I agree that you can choose to focus on one rather than the other, and that's part of why things get so labor-dick, because any proof could basically go in any direction. Either we're more interested in the premise or we're more interested in the question. But he thought the premise was very significant, and that's a big issue. He's not the only one. Others, Mason Hayer also brought it up. I thought it was a very significant premise. That's the way that it's discussed. And Rav Zevin thinks this is a very significant premise as well. And he brings that to his side, that really this shows you that it's not just about your action, it's about what's happening. You could ask, by the way, it's a little bit of a side question, but it's relevant, that there is a general principle that the Taz has, the famous Taz, such a famous Taz, that Dovid Cohen has an essay about this Taz, which he just expanded into a full-length book. And he says that this Taz is so well known that if someone says the famous Taz, they're talking about this Taz. And therefore, he entitled the book that he wrote about this Taz, Hataz Hayadua. Famous Taz, this is the most famous Taz in the whole Shulchan. What is this Taz talking about? The Taz has a principle that even though this is very relevant to Parsha Shoftim, when you get to it, the last pasuk of the first Aliyah, by Tanit Rabban, because we know the rabbis sometimes come and prohibit things that the Torah doesn't prohibit. That's very often what they're doing. Right? They come and add on new prohibitions that are not there in the Torah. But, says the Taz, they can't prohibit something that the Torah specifically says is mutter. They prohibit things the Torah doesn't talk about. They can't come and prohibit something that the Torah says is mutter. They can't contradict the direct Torah. They can only address areas where the Torah doesn't spell out one way or another. Yes? Right, so there, it's a good point. There, the Torah never says, blow shofar on Shabbos Rosh Hashanah. The Torah says, blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Whatever day of the week it is. So the rabbi said, but if it falls out on Shabbos, don't blow it then. So we know that the Torah didn't distinguish. We know that it could have been any day of the week. And therefore we know, leave the Torah alone, we blow the shofar on Shabbos. But had the Torah said, blow shofar on Shabbos Rosh Hashanah, the Taz would say they couldn't come.
Like,
Right, well, on the agent.
Exactly, exactly, very good. So that might be a proof.
On the agent specifically.
Exactly, that's why some say that's why there is no rabbinical prohibition to have a bris mila on Shabbos. Or some ask the question differently. How come the rabbis didn't prohibit shofar on every Rosh Hashanah? Because of the prohibition to play musical instruments on Shabbos and Yom Kippur. Right? So we should say that forget about Shabbos. Rosh Hashanah falls on Yom Kippur almost every year. Sorry?
On Shabbos, it can be Yisur D'Rabbanan, but also be Motzah.
Right, so there, but that's the Yisur D'Rabbanan is not, definitely you can't carry the shofar on Shabbos. But the rabbis made an Yisur D'Rabbanan, don't even blow shofar because we're afraid you might carry. So why don't we say also, don't even blow shofar on any Rosh Hashanah because we're afraid you might fix an instrument, like we normally prohibit instrument playing on Yom Kippur. So the answer is, based on the Taz, that no, it's clear, the Torah tells us to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. So the rabbis can't come and contradict something the Torah tells us. They can contradict something that we could figure out by default. So since we know the Torah didn't tell us not to blow shofar on Shabbos, then yes, technically speaking, by Torah law, if Shabbos and Rosh Hashanah coincide, you blow shofar, but the rabbi said don't. But anything explicit in the Torah, they can't contradict. That's the Taz of principle. Do you have a question about that?
Yeah, for
the
shrimp, why would
that
just be
a shrimp?
What's really one shrimp?
Now, fixing the music instrument, that would be an issue of the right. You're afraid you're going to fix it, so you make Xera not to blow it, not to play it. So that's one Xera, not to play the music instrument. So why should that also apply on Rosh Hashanah? The same way I can't blow a trumpet on Shabbos, I shouldn't be able to blow a shofar on Rosh Hashanah. So here, we raise the question. So if we know that Maisa Shabbos is an Isser Drabbanan, that the rabbi did prohibit us from benefiting from something that we cooked on Shabbos, how are they able to do this? The Gemara just told us that it's essentially, it's a pasuk in the Torah that Maisa Shabbos is mukkah. The rabbi now came and contradicted that. How are they able, in terms of the Taz, how are they able to contradict Torah law? That's an interesting question. And what's even more interesting, you know, when you think about this, is kind of getting perspective from this, the Dvar Yehoshua, who is a unbelievable Gom, Dvar Yehoshua was a Rav in Tel Aviv, and he died a few decades ago. He wrote a fascinating treatise, a tremendous So he says, it's not pshat that the rabbi said Maisa Shabbos is mutter, so the Torah said Maisa Shabbos is mutter, and the rabbis came and prohibited it. That's not the mechanics. What happened was that it's at the core of the issue we're talking about. That they added a layer to what Shabbos is about. That by Torah law, Shabbos is about being oppressed. Like this whole principle is. So therefore, logically speaking, as a reflection of Torah law, there's no prohibition on the effect. There's no prohibition of Maisa Shabbos. What did the rabbis do? They came and added a whole new layer. They said it's not just about your being oppressed. It's also about the second layer. It's also about what's happening. So then, as a logical extension of that, it comes out also that the effect is also prohibited. So it's not that they contradicted it then, this is mutter from Torah law, they came and prohibited it. They added a new layer to how Shabbos is perceived, and that has consequential effects. A fascinating idea provokes the whole question, why would they do that? Why were the rabbis motivated to do that? What's the rabbinical goal? Normally, the rabbis are motivated because they want to protect Torah law. And we're afraid that if we don't make this fence, we'll come and violate another marriage. Here, apparently we're saying that the rabbis perceive some fear that if we just let you function based on your actions, you'll somehow come to Chol Shabbos. And therefore they had to add a whole level of environment. It's really a fascinating idea we're thinking about. If you have any thoughts, please feel free to share them at some point. It opens up all kinds of avenues.
Hi. Couldn't you say that they have a Joshua on the Pasuk Shabbos Kodesh, Vein Maaseh Kodesh, but that's also not explicit in the Torah.
Right, then that gets into the whole discussion of what qualifies as explicit. So one could say that's
I mean, the Rambam is between the Drush versus the Torah.
Correct. So that could be another approach to answering this question. So if you read Dr. Cohn's essay, he gets into this issue of, he points out that the Taz did not start the story, that there are many Rishonim who clearly were working off this premise. This is an idea that we find throughout, before and after the Taz. But there are different variations of it. So what does it mean to be explicit in the Torah? Does it only mean a pasuk that straight out says something? Or is a drasha considered to be explicit? And you're right, there's probably some differences about that. So that could be a good meaning. So we hear it all over. To those who say that if a drasha counts explicit, you need a different answer. For those who say that it doesn't, you need a this answer now.
In the machlokes by Rabbi and Tzipora about over something that's
also
the so if you do something against the Torah, such as having a lot of that, and if you hold that it's not in general, that it's not Mahani, and therefore it can't be a Malacha Mashiach, and it wouldn't be a problem.
Which I think that in general is a different principle. What you're saying, Sam is saying that there is a machlokis in the Gemara and Torah, whether or not there's a principle of kol man da'amar rahmana lo sabit yadu lo mahani. When the Torah says not to do something, it's a prohibition of doing something, then if you do it, it doesn't have halachic status. Again, specifically halachic status. The Torah says don't kill somebody, but if you kill somebody, they're dead. They don't have the ability to take away the death of the person. But halachically, if you do something prohibited and it requires a halachic status, then it shouldn't, that halachic status may or may not take effect depending on this machlokas. So how's it going to work? So if you do a malacha on Shabbos, that's another area. So that's an inherent flaw in Shabbos.
It's therefore not really there anymore halachically. So it would then explain, it could also maybe answer the Yosef's question.
So it's not really there, but then you wouldn't have Shabbos candles. You're saying that, or you're saying by definition it can't be because
you it can't be lighted.
Interesting. You're not doing this thing. The fact that they're considered lit shows you that you didn't do any Aveira and didn't have any reason. Looking back is basically right. It's creative. Okay. So basically, one more text that's also brought into this whole discussion. There are many more texts that brought into this whole discussion. It's a very labyrinthic story. It's an ongoing fight. Jeff was writing very recently. He passed away just a few years ago. So this is a fight that's been going on at least from the time of, I think at least the past 200 years. It's clearly relevant to a lot of things. But one of the other major proofs that's brought in that the Beis Meir himself brings, and Rav Spangl brings, and he thinks it's a very significant proof, is there's a Gemara in Brachos, in Daf and Gimel. I don't remember if it was not. But the Gemara there talks about a candle that was lit on Shabbos by a non-Jew, and the Gemara says you shouldn't use that candle for Havdalah, for Baruch Hareish, because Lo Shabbas Mulach. This candle was not free of Mulach. So what Mulach? Non-Jew with the candle, he's allowed to do Mulach. So it's as if you're saying that there's something in the act of Havdalah. It's not just about a Jew violating Shabbos, but that Havara itself has some significance. So the fact that it was lit on Shabbos, that taints it somehow. So some felt this was very significant. The Beis Meir quotes this in the Kashan himself. He was the one who was the earliest, perhaps, Shlichus advocate. No, non-Shlichus advocate. He said, but wait a minute, what do we do with this Gemara? The Joseph Engel quotes this as a big proof against those who we didn't like anyway. That it shows you that there is something in the action itself. So the Beis Meir raises this issue. The Beis Meir says, maybe what the Gemara means, and this is how it's a Gemara, is that not that it really means there's a real Aveira. This isn't a real Din Menat Torah. What it means is that there's a Remez Aveira. It's boxy, doesn't sound so Shabbos did, or so Havdalah did, and say, okay, I'm going to use a candle that was lit on Shabbos. That even though it was lit behead there, and there's no real taint to it, but use that for your Shabbos ritual, it evokes some love. There's a remez out there. Maybe that's what the Gemara means. That's how the Beis Meir satisfies himself.
So he thinks it's just like a remez Meir's
Probably. Yeah, probably that would be the case. So when he says this in the Gemara, he's not saying, oh my gosh, this candle is crazy, this candle is high of steel. He's saying the Gemara is saying that it's evocative of an Amira, so therefore it's evocative of a Malacha, rather. Let's put it that way. So therefore it shouldn't be, it's not an appropriate choice for a Havdalah. The Dvar Yehoshua of Rivarenberg, we mentioned a minute ago, said according to me it works fine. Because I'm saying that when we have Torah, it's one thing, the Rabbanim is another level. So it's certainly possible this Gemara is a Rabbanim. So the Rabbanim is a reality to the effect of Shabbos. When Torah, you're right. When Torah, there's no significance to a candle being lit by a non-Jew on Shabbos. But the Rabbanim, it has a status to it, which is not Shabbosic, and that's what the Gemara means. Okay. So far, so good? Everybody with me? Okay, so those are some of the major proof texts that are used as a part of this fight. There's a few others also, which we will get to, which we're going to put in the proper context. So these are some of the major battleground texts. So let's say you're able to survive all these challenges, and you still hold stark from this zone, that essentially it's all about your being at rest, and if you have a malacha happen, and you are still at rest, that's not a violation of malacha menat Torah. What possible ramifications would that have for halacha? Aside from a shlichus point that we mentioned, provoke the whole issue, can you think of any other halachic impact that may possibly happen? What are the possible differences that might come up? That's you. So one area where it's discussed is, what if you have a malacha that you can do mentally? You can do without moving, anyone looking at you is not going to see you do a malacha. But somehow you're able to control things with your mind. Is that a violation of Shabbos? Well, what kind of example would you have of that? There are a few examples, but then I covered it might be one example. And I put a pasuk on the Mar Makom, which you may not have known what it was there for. In Parshas Beshalach, so the Torah tells us about the man, right, the extra man that was sent on Erev Shabbos. And the Torah says, in the context of preparing for Shabbos, the Torah says, that which you have to bake, bake, and that which you have to cook, cook. Right, Rashi quotes from the Mechilta that you want to prepare your man on the evening on Shabbos, so you have to prepare it from Erev Shabbos. You want to have cooked man, you want to have baked man, you want your man to turn into challah and to cholent, so do that on Friday afternoon. Let me ask you a question. How did they do that in the Midbar? How was man turned into different foods? Sorry? Did they really grind it up? You could Pashas turn it into shalant by thinking it's shalant. Right, the whole idea is
the
taste, right? So they make it taste the way you want. You have to actually do anything to prepare it.
Where does it say that you change the taste by your thoughts?
It's a chazal.
Right, I mean, psukim tastes like honey.
See, on a psukim level, you think there is something you have
so
to do? Like our general assumption is that that's your machshava alone does it. Right?
You change the texture.
Is that the case? You have to cook it in order to change the texture? That's not the indication that we have. Right, where's the pasuk again? The pasuk says about the Talmud Makomos list. The Rashi quotes from his Mechilta that the preparation, which we assume is machshava related, that had to be done before Shabbos. So supposedly there's a Das Kenyan Baliatosis, which I was trying to find before, I didn't find right away, where he says that in order to do this, you have to actually say something out loud. And some latest forum suggests, an essay about this in the Chavisal Sasharan as well, that maybe the idea that they have to find some action for you to do, rather than assuming it could just happen through Machshava, is also a reflection of this idea, that if it was just a machshava, so then it wouldn't necessarily be also to do that on Shabbos. If you could cook the food through your mind, that wouldn't necessarily be considered to be a malacha. And the Das Kanim has to say that you had to think something in order for that to be a violation, had to say something rather, in order for that to be a violation of Shabbos. Fascinating idea. This also comes up, this is also invoked in the discussion about animals, which I only want to very briefly talk about because it's a whole sugya of what machamer means. There's a whole idea of different levels of animal involvement in malachos. We see when you get to choresh, so there is a concept that choresh is generally done with animals. That might be simply karisha. And then there's an isser called machamer, which means making an animal do a malacha for you, which is a little bit more active involvement. It's a question of what qualifies as machamer. So let's say you're sitting at home and you trick your dog into turning the TV on. So is that considered to be malacha, so to speak? If you're assuming turning on the TV is malacha, or turning on a light? So you trick your dog turning on a light. So is that the malacha? So there is a literature about that, which again draws on the concept of makam and other things that we'll get into later. But something that draws on this question as well, that can you be considered in violation of a malacha if you're not really doing anything, then you're essentially ordering or tricking your animal into doing it, is that going to be considered a malacha or not? Yes?
Is that better than a mirlacha?
Why is that better than a mirlacha? Because the question whether there's any shlichus at all here.
We're already assuming that by the Akhman there's shlichus, or there's some sort of...
There could be the real shlichus for an Akhman Mechumah.
Right, but here it's even less. There's, I mean, here it's not that you have the animal being your shlichus, it's directly going from your action. I mean, you can't
right,
even have
so
a
the question
is, it's more
right,
you.
So the question is that an action. Maybe it doesn't count as an action. Maybe it's no less of a, no more of an action than simply provoking it through your machshava. So that's the question. Again, it's a little bit more complicated sugya, but we get to remember that it possibly draws off this principle as well. Another major practical issue, think about it, come up with a couple of practical issues that are possibly relevant here. So another major issue in which this comes up is the issue of the earlier literature, like 10 years ago, as opposed to this year, and the earlier literature comes up in terms of faxing. Let's say you send a fax to an area where it's Shabbos. And it's not Shabbos where you are.
That's so you're probably now calling, let's say, for different times I'm calling.
Correct. So the whole time zone issue, nowadays it can be applied to many different settings. But a lot of the literature focuses on faxes, because I guess that was the most commonly relevant, especially in a pre-email era. So if that issue wasn't being discussed, even though phones predated faxes, but I guess it was much more common that people asked about sending faxes and about leaving messages. So what if you are in an area where it's not Shabbos, either before or after, depending what direction you're going in? So it's either Friday afternoon or Saturday night where you are. And if you want to send a fax to somewhere where it is Shabbos. So can that be considered a violation of Shabbos? Can that be considered a chil Shabbos if, as far as you're concerned, it is Friday? It is not Shabbos at all. You are completely at rest during the time that is Shabbos for you. And it happens to be you're provoking an action somewhere else, but you're not doing that action over there. You're doing the action in New York, where it's not Shabbos yet. So let's say New York to Israel, so it's a Friday morning. So you send the fax to Israel, so the fax is going on in Israel on Shabbos. But you're not connected to that. Your action is taking place on a Friday morning where you are, and therefore you're bound by Friday morning rules, not by Shabbos rules. So as you can imagine, there is an extensive literature about this, which perhaps maybe we can look at in its own setting. Maybe that this has been a normally structured week, by the way, as we said in the past, that we said last week, that in a normally structured week, we'll probably do sugya during the week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then on a Sunday, we would focus on some of the halachic implications of the previous week's sugya. So God willing, for example, this coming week, so we'll start in Melachas Zoreya, and on Sunday, the following Sunday, we'll talk about practical Zoreya issues and the halachal mice in terms of Zoreya. So if this has been a normally structured week, that may be something we could talk about today, about the broader faxing issues
that relate to this sugya. But just very briefly now, one of the major elements that's brought up is this svara, that maybe we should say that it should be mutter. And this is approach, again, the Dvar Yeshua has a very brief tshuva about this, where he thinks it's pashut, that's true. He thinks it to him, and this is not the only thing said about the subject, but he thinks to him it's pashut, that's true, that if you send a fax somewhere where it's Shabbos, and it's not Shabbos for you, this principle gets you off the hook. This principle, which he thinks is true, gets you off the hook. You are dressed on Shabbos. The fact that the malach is happening in a different time zone does not address anything you're doing. Accurate.
Someone told me it's an issue though. If you're in Israel, it's Motzei Shabbos, and you want to go on J Post to read an article. It's very possible that there's some Jew who's not religious who wrote that article on Shabbos and put it online on Shabbos.
Right.
And then you're having hana'ah from someone else's malach.
Right, the problem is, so how long does that go for? So yes, that's true, but then you have to wait Kidei Shiaser, you have to wait enough time for him to do it, because not to be honest, forever.
How long does it take? If it could take forever to write an article, or it could take 5 minutes.
Right, so that's the thing, that's why it's hard to pin down, because normally the prohibition, which is going to be a prohibition to Rabbanan, but the prohibition is going to be that it doesn't apply forever, it applies that you have to allow the amount of time to pass that you could have done it after Shabbos. So it's hard to pin that down when it comes to So in any event, this issue, the faxing issue, which has many different nuances to it, but this whole literature about the shlichus on Shabbos, possible lack of there being one, is brought into this discussion as well. You find a couple of other issues which comes up, a couple of other applications, broader applications. For example, somebody mentioned before Grumma. The Gemara says on the surface, the Gemara on Kaf Chaf, I don't think I put this, I didn't put this in the Gemara columns, but the Gemara on Kaf Kuf Chaf, Shabbos tells us that, at least on a Torah level, Grama on Shabbos is Mutter, on a Torah level, again, without getting into the Rabbanis. So, in other areas, sometimes Grama is not Mutter. So why is Grama Mutter? So here again, so some Achronim explain, such as the Egle Tal, who says such a thing in Choresh, and the Shuva Space Yitzchak, not to be confused with the Harbis Yitzchak General, but the Rabitzchak Shmelkis, it's a great posek. So he also explained as follows, that the reason Grama is Mutter on Shabbos Mehatover is because it's all about your action. You're doing something. So if you are not doing the law, but you are causing it, that's not going to be traced back to you on a Torah level. Similarly, the Or Sameach has a chiddush, which not everyone accepted, others disagree with. And we'll have to see whether some of our learners are going to come to are consistent with this principle. That if you do something through koach, it's very similar, koach kocho. So you cause something to happen, you punch one thing and it punches something else, that's kocho. So then let's say it goes another level, it's koach kocho. So the Or Sameach says, in Hilcho Shabbos, that's also not connected to you. That because already if it's too many steps separated from what you're doing, so then that's already not called a malacha, because the malacha means that you are doing something. Hi.
Well, does that necessarily have to specifically do with the Shabbos and this concept of it, just in general?
Also, but another area is find the
also there is find koach kocho is not necessarily connected to
you. Right, so you have to figure out what area is relevant, is relevant model for Shabbos.
Right, meaning
and it could be that Shabbos maybe it's not even the case. It's,
I'm saying meaning it might not have anything to do with this idea of shlichus on Shabbos.
It might
have to do with koach kocho because we see in other places.
Except that some places it is, so you have to figure out what the dominant model is. But it is brought into this discussion as a possible ramification of this whole idea. So, a few other points to mention about this, but at least one point I want to try to get into before we run out of time, is how does it fit in general? So we said, okay, shlichus to a non-Jew, apparently on a level of Manat Torah, is not an issue. And apparently that reflects this principle. Shlichus to a Jew would be a little more complicated because essentially, an avera is happening. There is a malacha taking place at your instigation. According to some versions of this theory, that might be different. What if you have shlichus to a Jew, and he's not doing an avera? you ask a Jew to do a malacha for you, and it's not going to mean him doing an aveira. Can you think of an example of that? Okay, well, the whole action will come to that, actually. Another good example, maybe we'll talk about that a little bit tomorrow in the beginning. But here again, Tavshani here, that's a possible example. Bill, what were you going to say?
Different time zones.
Different time zones. Okay, so that could be. Or before we come on to the communication of different time zones, so there was a debate in the Rishonim between the Rashba and the Ram. What happens if you brought in Shabbos early? Tosefta Shabbos. So you brought in Shabbos early, and your neighbor has not yet brought in Shabbos. The Rashba maintains that you are allowed to ask that neighbor to do malacha for you. Happens to be the Ram disagrees, but the Rashba is very well known on this position. The Rashba maintaining that you're allowed to ask somebody to do malacha for you when he has not yet brought in Shabbos. So if you are from the pro no shlichus school, however the good way to say that, some sofer, the majority of the same tone now with no shlichus. So that all makes a lot of sense. Right? Because why should it be a problem? There's no shlichus for anybody, basically. So especially here, he's not doing malacha and you're a guest. Everything's all very well and good. The Rashba makes a lot of sense. Rav Zevin is confronted with this. Rav Zevin, remember, so he is against the school. He thinks that it's not just about what you're doing, it's about what's happening, what you're provoking. So how could Rav Zevin answer this question? How could Rav Zevin work with a Rashba? Anyone want to take a stab at it?
Just be my thoughts about what's considered Tosefta Shabbos, what you're taking in.
Okay, so yes, maybe it relates to the gather of Tosefta Shabbos, but how?
So, if you say my focus is about whether or not you made an extra Shabbos or if you're just accepting certain dinim on yourself, then you have a lot more leeway to...
But if you're saying if it's not actually Shabbos, but everyone agrees that you accept not to do malacha during that time.
Maybe you didn't accept not to ask someone else to do malacha for you.
So you're saying it's just because it's a drabbanan, so it has...
Yeah, you get to play around with it. More leeway.
Okay, Jonathan.
Well, that's a drabbanan or that it's optional.
Okay, so it's probably... It's a chiyur, the rice you do it, essentially...
It's optional.
It's you control it, nothing is optional, but you control when it happens, essentially. But whether you want to call it Rabbanan or not, you want to call it optional or not, because they're all pointing in a certain direction. Says Rav Zevin, yeah, Tosefta Shabbos, any time that I bring in Shabbos before Shabbos starts, even though I'm tired and I told you to do that, but any time I bring in Shabbos early, so clearly that is a personal thing. That is about my not doing malacha. You can't say that there's an entity of not having malacha happen when it's already individualized. So let's say, if we were to say Shabbos objectively starts at 7, and you could bring in Shabbos anytime from Plag, let's say 6, Shabbos objectively starts at 6, and we'll call Plag Amincha at 4:45, so you could bring in Shabbos at 4:45, at 5:15, at 5:30, anytime you choose. So at 6 o'clock is Shabbos according to everybody. So says Rav Zevin, sure, when you bring in Shabbos at 4:45, so clearly, that's a personal Shabbos. That's all about what you're doing. We can't say that there's an entity of not having malacha during a time that's all based on the individual. Once 6 o'clock comes, then it's going to be Shabbos for everybody. Then there's an existence of Shabbos that you can't provoke malachas. But during your personal time, so then it's only about you're not doing malacha. So during the Tosefta's time, I'll agree with everybody else. And once Shabbos actually comes in, that's a different story. Yes?
You wouldn't be able to learn for, let's say, the facts in cases like this, because it's definitely Shabbos still for the, it wouldn't be relatable, his understanding.
That wouldn't be a direct proof to this, but it could be that everyone else would agree for other reasons. Then he might still say the facts might still be awesome for that.
But not.
Right. Correct. So, does all of this shed light, maybe, on the nature of malachos on Shabbos and why there is some type of a division? What does this tell us about how we should define malachos Shabbos as a whole? That, I think, will be our cliffhanger for tomorrow before we actually transfer to Zoreh. Because I just want to quickly review what we spoke about before we let you go. And then tomorrow we'll pick up on what I think all of this reflects about the nature of how Malacha Shabbos is set up and what approach we can take from here on in. So essentially, what did we discuss today? So we talked about the different versions of this idea that there's no shlichus on Shabbos, apparently saying because it's all about your being at rest. We mentioned different ways to say that. Either you call it that an Isser Gavra, or you say it's not the terminology of Gavra so much, but it's the practicality of your being at rest. Or you say because of the pasuk saying Laman Yanuach, or like Yosef Engel suggested, that it's about the temporary nature of Shabbos, which can never transfer to a status beyond the individual according to an approach you don't agree with. The temporary nature of Shabbos is what directs it. And then we talked about the various proofs and a way of deepening the whole issue. We talked about the question of the difference between Shvius and Shabbos, that Mr. Karelitz points out that Shvius is only about advancing the growth of the produce, while on Shabbos would be considered Zareya even if you are maintaining produce, because you look at your action rather than the effect. And then we talked about, is there a possible difference that if you say there's no shlichus for an akum, maybe that's just because you're at rest and he can't do a malacha, but what if you ask a Jew to do a malacha for you, is that possibly different? It could be that even the school of thought might say that's different because he is doing a malacha and you provoked it. And then we discussed the various proof texts that have brought into this whole battle. You mentioned, for example, that Zevin disagrees with this whole no shlichus school. And a number of texts are brought in. We discuss some methodological differences. When you have a kasha that your Yisroel answers, what do you do with the fact that Rishonim asked that kasha but give a different answer? So a primary example here, Rebuki Yosef, who asked the question about lighting a candle on Erev Shabbos as you're obligated to do. How does that match with Yochanan's view that a fire is always traced back to the person who did it? They should be shown that's it. His answer is that it only is traced back to the first moment, and that is if you're constantly doing it. So why doesn't he just say, are you so? And we mentioned different approaches. Either he disagrees with are you so, like the site one and others have said, or he disagrees, but you can still maintain it. Or maybe he agrees, but he's coming to make an easier point or a different point, and therefore he doesn't need it. Or we mentioned a way to distinguish that maybe shlichus is not about your action. Shlichus is something you get credited for or blamed for, but it's not considered to be your action. And then Rebbe Yosef was considering that maybe the flame is considered to be your action and maybe you should be liable for it the whole time, and that's what he came to say, no, that's not the case in the end. And then we talked about the whole question on Mira L'Aklam, is this a Drabana? It's the same methodological question, what do we do with the Drabana? Is the Drabana a reflection of the fact that the opposite of what it shows, or what it shows, the fact that it's not the Raisa, but the fact that the rabbis made the din. So what do we do with Amir L'Akum? And what do we do with that Rashi and Kufman Gimel, which says when you give your wallet to the non-Jew to carry, it's Kishlucho, how does that reflect on this whole story? And then we talk about a third level of methodological problem, when the Gemara says Ahavamina, and then Maskana, and then there's a din Rabbanan on that, three different directions. What's the most significant point? Because we discussed that the Gemara says that Maisa Shabbos should have been Aser, but the Pasuk says it's Mutar, and then it's a Din Rabbanan to Aser it. What's the most relevant point? We mentioned that some took that question very seriously, including the Shoal Umeshik, who thought that was a bomb question on the whole principle, but he says Shlichus could still be off the table because by splitting the one sending and the one doing, so therefore it's a Malachas Machshavas issue. So he'll agree there's no Shlichus, but he doesn't agree that it's all about your being at rest. And then we mentioned the Dvar Yeshua's tremendous Chiddush that Menat Torah is about your being at rest, and Midrabanan, they created a different environment. Then we discussed how that deals with the issue of the Taz, that you can't have the Rabbanans that directly contradict a Torah principle. And then we talked about the question of how do we deal with the issue of the Gemara that says you can't use a Nair that was written by a non-Jew on Shabbos for Havdalah, which again, some of the earlier sources thought that was kind of a very significant question. And others said, no, it doesn't mean on a Torah level, it just means a hint of an Avera. And Dvar Yeshua says also works for him as well. And then we got into some of the practical differences that might come up from saying that it's all about your being at rest
We talked about the question of what if you could do an Avera, if you could do a Malacha through Machshava without doing anything. For example, like cooking the man, where the Torah seems to say you have to cook the man before Shabbos. Is that a reflection of something or not? You mentioned the Das Kane, who said it wasn't just thinking, you had to actually say something. We talked about how that possibly has ramifications for instructing animals to do something, which is a more complicated sugya related to Macham. We'll talk about it a different time, but to what extent does that come into this discussion? We talked about the question of faxes very briefly, also a longer discussion, but the question of how sending a fax to a different time zone possibly affected by this discussion. We talked about Grumma, the fact that the Gemara says in the Torah, Grumma is what the Rosh Hashanah is, that also a result of this. Also the issue of Kokoko, is that perhaps relevant? And then we talked about the Rosh Hashanah, you know, the Rambam disagree with, that if you haven't brought Shabbos in yet, you can ask, if you have brought Shabbos in, your neighbor hasn't, you can ask your neighbor to do Malacha for you, which works very well with Arya Sov. It seems to challenge those who argue on it with Rav Zevin. So Rav Zevin suggests that no, that when you bring Shabbos in early, so that's for sure a personal thing, it's all about what you're doing. And it's only when Shabbos comes in for real that this idea that it's about what's happening also becomes significant. So then we wanted to suggest that this perhaps gives us some perspective as far as how Malacha works as a whole, but we're going to suggest that tomorrow because we are out of time, so that's our cliffhanger. How's everybody doing? Does that make sense? Everybody following? Anything okay? Okay, you'll let me know if anything's too fast, too slow, too up, too down, too many, too out. You'll let me know? Okay, nobody's shy? Okay, so tomorrow's being scheduled because of Labor Day, so we'll see you here tomorrow morning at 9, then here at 11:30. Have a fantastic day.